From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The list of scheduled speakers at next week's Democratic National Convention is out, and it's being parsed for clues as to who's still in the running to be Joe Biden's running mate. He's expected to make that announcement any day now. Meanwhile, President Trump is floating the idea of accepting the Republican nomination later this month on sacred ground, the Gettysburg battlefield. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is watching it all. And Mara, you know, some names in the running to be Biden's running mate are scheduled to speak, but not in the VP slot, you know, and I'm just wondering if that's a fool's errand to try to make that meaningful. You know, what do you think about that? And who do you think at this point is the or are maybe the most likely candidates?
I think the most likely candidates are still that same handful of women. You know, Joe Biden has said he's going to pick a woman, whether it's Kamala Harris, Susan Rice, Gretchen Whitmer, Karen Bass. Those are the people who have been on the list for quite some time. And of course, Gretchen Whitmer is the only white female on that short list. But I think the list has remained the same. Sounds like he's about to make his decision because the vetting committee has pretty much disbanded. And it could be as early as today that we find out.
Well, so what do you think for everybody who's sitting home, you know, got all the names and the lists on whiteboards and, you know, trying to, you know, look at those tea leaves? I mean, should we be looking at the list of speakers?
Oh, I think that that's that is actually a fool's errand, but it's fun and it's going to be over very soon. It could be over today, so go ahead. But I still think, you know, of all my conversations with Democrats, all signs seem to point to Kamala Harris, but with the caveat that Joe Biden hasn't decided and he often takes his time deciding.
Yeah. Well, 100 prominent black men signed a letter hoping they could make him decide that it would be a black woman because they said to him, you will lose the election if you don't choose a black woman as a running mate. And this was entertainers, pastors, business leaders, athletes. But I'm wondering, Mara, if you think that Biden really needed that public pressure. It would seem in this moment in time, that's the choice he'd want to make, one of these incredibly capable black
women. That's what I think. I think that letter was really aimed at Gretchen Whitmer. She's the only white person on that list. Everyone else is a person of color or a black woman. So I don't think he needed that kind of public pressure. But it does show you that of all the people on the list, there is a backlash brewing to at least one of them, and that's Gretchen Whitmer. You haven't seen the same kind of opposition, public opposition, to Kamala Harris, for instance.
Well, by the way, you're saying Elizabeth Warren is not in the running.
I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think so. Although she's a thought leader in the party, and she certainly has influenced a tremendous amount of his agenda.
Yeah. The Democratic National Convention will be all online this year. What does that mean for the post-convention bounce that the candidates look for? Hillary Clinton got?
Well, first of all, who knows? Because nobody's ever run a presidential campaign in a pandemic. But most people I talk to assume that the post-convention bounce will be very small this year for both candidates because they're not having the kind of big, excitement-filled, crowded conventions like we have in the past. That being said, the Democrats have had a lot longer time to plan for a virtual convention than the Republicans because they've been scaling theirs back for months. And the big question is, are they about to produce the best four-night television show ever seen in history, or will it kind of be ho-hum? Hmm.
Well, and they will be competing in that arena with a president who's obviously trying to make the best television show. What do you make of that tweet that he may accept the Republican nomination for president from the Gettysburg battlefield or the White House, both locations likely to violate ethics rules or just some people's moral sense of what's right to politicize? But, you know, this is a president that gave an interview to Fox News inside the Lincoln Memorial, gave an interview at Normandy. What do you think happens here?
Well, certainly Trump isn't worried about offending people's sense of what's right or wrong or any kind of norm. Now, there are legal questions, ethical questions about what kind of federal property you can make a convention nominating speech or acceptance speech on. And I'm sure the White House lawyers will be figuring that out. Is there some part of Gettysburg that he could be on without violating ethics rules? It's certainly a lot easier for the president to set this up at the White House. But he's clearly looking for the kind of dramatic backdrop, not unlike Mount Rushmore, that would give his campaign a boost.
A quick thought from you, Mara, on the fact that it's been primary season. It's primary day today. For six states, the focus is on Minnesota, where the Democrat, the Representative Ilhan Omar, is facing a tough challenge. Other progressive candidates have done very well this primary season. What will you be looking for here?
Right. She's the only member of the squad left with a primary, the four young progressive women of color. And she has a really stiff challenge from an attorney named Anton Melton Moe. He's getting a lot of money. There's been a certain amount of unhappiness with her. There have been attacks on her for allegedly making anti-Semitic statements. We know that the other members of the squad have not had primary challenges. Rashida Tlaib beat hers back very handily. So that's what we're watching today for the Democrats. Yeah. How does Ilhan Omar do?
Right. And very briefly, the unemployed have now gone over a week without that additional money from the federal government. The president signed those actions and directives to address this. White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow says the money will go out in 2 weeks, but he doesn't have the power of the purse. Congress does. And they're gone. They're out of session.
I think everyone's taking a big political risk here. For the president to sign these executive orders and then have people not get a bigger unemployment check or still face eviction, I think that he will be responsible for that. And then members of Congress, including the Democrats, they are allowing people to go without these unemployment checks, which, by the way, have kept the economy going in large part.
Yeah.
They have stopped negotiating.
Not good. Yeah, not good. Yeah. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Seattle, where the police chief is stepping down. Carmen Best made the announcement last night after the city council voted for significant cuts to the police department and a reduction of the chief's pay. Over the last few weeks, Best and the department have been criticized for handling of protests in the city. And joining us with the latest now is Chris Daniels, chief reporter at King 5 in Seattle. And Chris, these initial cuts are actually less than the 50% reduction that was initially on the table. Are they still the big reason that Chief Best says she's leaving the department?
Well, yes, Tanya, good to talk with you again. To your question, it ended up only being about 2% of the overall police budget when so many protesters and activists had asked for 50% of the budget cut. But it appears for Best, the tipping point for her was an amendment that kind of came out of nowhere last week in the final negotiations in the budget committee. To cut her pay by 40%, a six-figure cut. And apparently over the weekend, she said, that's it. I'm done. And there had also been protests outside her house, which had flared up in nearby Snohomish County. And a combination of those things, she just felt like it was time. Her quote late yesterday was, it's time. And apparently that cut that was proposed, although it was not approved yesterday, there was a much smaller cut approved. But the idea that it was done without any sort of discussion, without any sort of questioning, without having her in front of the council, I think is the reason why she ultimately decided this was the move.
Yeah. And so she's been on the force for about 30 years now. She's the first Black woman to hold this position in Seattle. Mayor Jenny Durkan has said she hopes this move will kind of change the department's fractured relationship with the city council. But there's been lots of criticism, as you kind of alluded to, for what some have said was the department's excessive use of force against protesters after the death of George Floyd and those autonomous zones there. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the date was May 30th when the protests really started in downtown Seattle. And in those weeks that followed, there was the creation of the CHAZ or the CHOP, the Autonomous Zone, as it's been called. And there has been a lot of a national attention on that. But also tied up in that was the city and the police force backed off after several nights of confrontations between the police department and protesters outside the city's East Precinct. And there was a use of tear gas and pepper spray and blast balls. And it continued even after Best had said in a infamous Friday press conference that the city was going to ban the use of tear gas in any sort of demonstrations, and then 2 days later used it. And that left a credibility gap for her. There were definitely increasing criticism of the police chief, but it appeared she had weathered the storm through all of this, and she had been out in the forefront saying she was willing to talk about police reform and a re-envisioning, and had come up with millions of dollars in cuts for 2021 along with the mayor. And then through these final negotiations, it appears and the approval that the city council yesterday, that is why she is stepping down now. And she's 55 years old. She still had years ready to go on the force, but apparently yeah. She has had enough in the negotiations with the city council.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, what's next? Who will take over?
The deputy chief, Adrian Diaz, has been already appointed by the mayor, Jenny Durkin, to take over in September. Essentially, Chief Best is giving her 2 weeks notice, and there are going to be all sorts of questions about what this means for further cuts in the police department and also compliance with the consent decree. There is a federal case still over the top of the Seattle Police Department, so lots of questions.
Chris Daniels is chief reporter at King 5 in Seattle. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Tanya.
Are you alarmed by things your teen is seeing on social media? Mom, there's someone from the FTBA telling store workers they can get sued if they ask people to wear masks. Well, yes, people are doing that, but the Freedom to Breathe agency is completely bogus. Or maybe you're a teen wondering, is it true that a boy went blind from eating Pringles? Well, in a way, yes, he did. He ate only chips and junk food, and doctors in England said he had a vitamin B12 deficiency that led to blind spots. We know this because we checked the MediaWise Teen Fact-Checking Network. They research online claims and teach young people how to do it themselves. A Stanford report showed 2/3 of students couldn't tell the difference between news and paid ads. 52% said a grainy video claiming to show ballot stuffing was evidence of 2016 voter fraud. It was not. The MediaWise Teen Fact-Checking Network is the brainchild of the nonprofit Poynter Institute. It's supported by the Google News Initiative. 18-year-old Taya Barrett is a teen fact-checker. She's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Taya, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us, Alexa Volland, a MediaWise multimedia reporter formerly at the Tampa Bay Times, who leads the Teen Fact-Checking Network and joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Alexa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Taya, just let's start with you. I'd love you to tick off some of the myths or fake information that you're having to debunk.
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I fact-checked a lot of misinformation about how far apart we need to be in order to be safe, whether it's 27 feet apart or 6 feet apart, whether masks cause hypercapnia, and what contact tracing apps are doing to your phone.
Okay, well, so first of all, could you go back over your list and give us a true or false?
Yeah, so we don't need to be 27 feet apart. Reputable sources like the CDC or the World Health Organization all say that 6 feet apart is enough to keep us safe from coronavirus. Masks do not cause hypercapnia or carbon dioxide poisoning. They instead keep us safe. And contact tracing apps, there was people saying that they were just automatically downloaded into your phone, the government spying on us, but that's not true. You had to voluntarily opt in, and they were just in order to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Okay. So that's Taya Barrett, who is a teen fact checker with Teen Fact Checking Network. Let's bring back Alexa Volland, who leads this. We're hearing that young people, because they're online so much, are increasingly trafficking in conspiracy theories, things like QAnon, that aren't true. Is that why you came up with this, that there seems to be more of a need for it?
Absolutely. I think the MediaWise tips that we give can help teens spot all sorts of misinformation, not just conspiracy theories. MediaWise, when it was originally created, was to teach teenagers how to sort fact from fiction online. What makes the Teen Fact Checking Network unique is that our teens are using social media storytelling to virtually walk viewers through every step of how they fact checked these claims. Our main hub is currently Instagram. So our teen fact checkers are fact checking while simultaneously teaching skills and tools that professional journalists and fact checkers use, including screen recordings of their Google searches, and they will walk you through the steps of how to do a reverse image search or a reverse video search and show you the results.
Reverse image search?
Mm-hmm. So we found that a lot of the photos that have come out of recently the Black Lives Matter movement have been taken out of context. So by doing a reverse image search, plugging that photo into Google and seeing where else that same image exists, it allows for us to see if that photo has been digitally manipulated. It lets us see if it's a recent photo or is this photo from 2016 and it's been completely taken out of context. Or using a reverse video search, we used that for a couple of fact checks regarding the Black Lives Matter protests as well. There was a video that went viral that supposedly showed people trying to break into the White House. We found that it was actually a video from Ohio. So teens are enabling their peers with the skills to be able to fact check on their own in the future.
Give us a couple of things that you tell them. How do they figure out what's true?
One tip that we give that's really helpful is that if something online gives you an intense emotional reaction, that's a clue that it could be misinformation. If it makes you feel really angry or if it makes you feel validated. So instead of impulsively resharing, we really encourage teenagers and everyone to just hit the pause button and make sure that they have full context. We also encourage teens to ask themselves three questions. Who was behind the information? What is the evidence? And what are other sources saying?
And Taya, as you do this, I mean, some would ask, how do you make sure your personal bias, whatever that is, doesn't get in the way? I mean, you know, some people might think, oh, you're just going to tell me to go to the media outlets that you like, but I don't trust them, you know? So how do you distinguish between what's true and what's not?
One thing that we also really use at MediaWise is the concept of going straight to the source, going to the original post or the original speaker. So whether that's going to the FDA about hydroxychloroquine or the CDC about whether we should wear masks or not, rather than just a random Twitter user. And even if you can't go straight to a source like that, making sure that you're reading sources from both sides and making your own personal decision on what the truth is.
Well, and you put this out there, the truth. What's the response?
We've definitely gotten some pushback, but we've gotten a lot of positive feedback because people are seeing this misinformation going around on their timeline and they want to know, what is the truth? How can I keep my family safe? Is this viral post legit? They like knowing that what they're seeing is legit information.
Yeah. Well, we're reading that 86% of respondents polled on a MediaWise Instagram account said they were more likely to fact check on their own after seeing a fact check network story. Taya, give us a couple more things that you're seeing that young people in particular are believing.
I'm seeing a lot of posts about some of the Black Lives Matter protests, things that either cops have done or things that protesters have done. I've seen posts about climate change things and whether those are, you know, true or not. And those things that really latch on to the fears of young people, because we're growing up in a very scary time. Those are really the posts that I see going viral among young people.
Alexa, are you alarmed by what you're seeing young people in particular believe in? I mean, again, we're hearing lots of going down the rabbit hole of the completely false conspiracy theories like QAnon, because it's making its way onto things like TikTok, where young people are.
Oh, of course. A 16-year-old's Instagram discovery page looks very different compared to our own. And as fact checkers, it's been really interesting to see the types of misinformation that teenagers are being targeted with, which is why media literacy education is so important and why it's so important, especially at a young age. When someone gives you evidence, what is that evidence? Are they giving you a link to a credible news source? Are you just taking their word for it? We want them to ask, who is behind this information and do they have something to gain from the information? And of course, what are other sources saying? Working with teens, it's become really apparent that teens can kind of read one source or one website and they'll just kind of get off the page. We really encourage teens to use a practice called lateral reading, a term coined by the Stanford History Education Group. And instead of just sticking to one page, opening up a bunch of tabs and reading across all of them. And again, when we have an intense emotional reaction, we tend to not fact check. We kind of just kind of go on gut instinct and we hit that reshare button versus just taking a step back and doing a little research.
And what did you call that, lateral research, when you open a bunch of tabs?
Lateral reading. We also want to make sure that they're reading past the headline. So reading that article and taking those keywords and plugging it to a second tab and reading past the headline as well.
Yeah. And Teo, we're just a few weeks now away from a very important presidential election, maybe the first for some of the teens and young people that you are trying to help. Your thoughts on maybe media literacy is even more important now.
Yeah, it's definitely very important. I'm a first-time voter, as pretty much all of my friends are. Another part of MediaWise is the MediaWise Voter Project, which works to educate first-time voters. And I'm a campus correspondent for that as well. And we do media literacy virtual trainings on college campuses across the country. And that's really helped me see that there's just so much misinformation out there about the candidates, about how to vote. They might not go out to vote because they might not know how to, or during the coronavirus, they might not understand how to get their absentee ballot.
Or they're hearing the president of the United States saying mail-in votes are horrible. They're going to make the election rigged, even though every single study has shown there's very little voter fraud and very, very little mail-in voter fraud. You've got to overcome that megaphone.
Yes, definitely. That's a very big problem, that there's so much misinformation coming from the government that it's hard to discern what's real and what's fake. And it's hard to, you know, get inspired and find the time and the energy to go vote when you're hearing messages like that.
Well, we're going to hook people up if they want to learn more about MediaWise's Teen Fact Checking Network. Alexa, again, why is this important?
The Teen Fact Checking Network, they have debunked more than 400 claims. And long as social media exists, I think misinformation, out of context claims will find their way on people's timelines. And in my book, everything's worth a fact check.
That's journalist Alexa Vollen. She's head of the MediaWise Teen Fact Checking Network. We also spoke with 18-year-old Taya Barrett, a teen fact checker. The program is supported by the Google News Initiative. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
We have a saying, if your mother says she loves you, fact check it. While 30 million Americans remain unemployed because of the pandemic, the very rich are getting very richer. The Institute for Policy Studies estimates that America's 643 billionaires have seen their wealth grow by $685 billion since the pandemic began in March. And that's prompting some Democrats to call for a one-time wealth tax on capital gains made during the crisis. Meanwhile, President Trump said yesterday he's weighing capital gains tax cut. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Good. Lucky, grateful to be working. But we know so many Americans are struggling. They're either unemployed, they can't open their businesses. It's just terrible. But these people making so much money, who are they? Which industries? Or are they just making money on their money? What's happening?
Yeah, capital has actually done quite well in some parts during the financial crisis. We've talked about it before. You look at how the values of Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Tesla, other tech heavyweights, they've just swelled compared to the broader market and economy. You talk about real estate. Mortgage rates are minuscule for those who can get them, and homes get snapped up so quickly. So a lot of wealth is sloshing around, wealth gains, at least on paper.
So we've had these different thoughts about it. Democrats saying that he wants to, Democrats saying that they want to have this one-time tax. What would that be?
Yeah, there's this idea of a Make Billionaires Pay Act, and it would levy a one-time 60% tax on wealth gains made by billionaires between March 18th and January 1st. So that's to pay for out-of-pocket health care expenses for all Americans for a year. And that's clocked to current values to get you a $730 billion price tag on the wealth accumulated by all those billionaires since March 18. But that can't be done unilaterally, so it's unclear that all Democrats in the U.S. Senate would fall behind the idea of this pandemic windfall tax, to say nothing of Republican lawmakers in the White House.
Well, it's being proposed by Bernie Sanders, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, and Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Mark Zuckerberg would be the hardest hit by this. Jeff Bezos maybe would have to pay about $43 billion. I'm imagining a lot of that is Amazon.
Yeah, but look, this is all in the theoretical. So a lot of the criticism of this make billionaires pay tax, it's based on taxable events, capital gains normally are. So you're talking about these billionaires as though they've captured more than $700 billion in cash during the pandemic. No, they're paper gains. You look at your own brokerage statement, your own retirement statement. How much have you banked since March 18th? I mean, that fluctuates in background.
Yeah. Well, but meanwhile, the president wants to give him a break, a capital gains cut. So he can't do that without Congress. Could he do that with an executive order? And can he do that?
There's a tiny sliver of a loophole. I don't know if I just mixed metaphors. I mean, yes, he would need Congress to cut the 20% long-term capital gains rate, but he could also theoretically avoid Pelosi and Schumer by decreeing that capital gains be indexed to inflation, which lets you reduce the portion of your winnings that are taxable. But again, and no pun intended, these gains are very much on the margin and concentrated among the top 1%.
Any chance in the few seconds we have, Robin Farzad, that any of those people I mentioned, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, would volunteer, you know, to somehow give up some of the billions that they made off the pandemic in effect?
They might write columns and up their philanthropic efforts, but you're talking about tens of billions of dollars for 6 months of behavior. I just don't see it happening.
No is the answer. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
As COVID-19 cases rise, many school districts are starting the year online, and many more parents don't want to repeat the experience of last spring where online education was for hours a day on Zoom. Forming a pandemic pod or private quarantine of students led by an instructor is one way to bolster learning during the pandemic, but it comes at a cost financially and socially. And Stephanie Bryles is watching the debate unfold on Facebook. She has a group she started called Quarantine Houston. She's a mom who recently taught kindergarten. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
So why did you start this group?
I was getting inundated with phone calls from desperate parents. I left in February of last year to have my baby. And so shortly after, you know, school went online. And so they were already calling me. And then this summer, as everybody started realizing we're not going back in the fall, you know, my phone continued to blow up. And I thought, I don't know how I can help all these parents. So I just randomly started this Facebook group thinking, you know, maybe a couple hundred moms would get on and kind of network, and it just blew up.
Yes. I mean, there are similar Facebook groups across the country, but your group specifically has more than 5,600 members now. One post on the site today that a parent wrote says, looking for someone to come over four times a week for 2 hours, 8 hours total a week, to check homework and play with our 11-year-old girl, schedule flexible, paying $35 an hour. Is this the kind of thing mainly that parents want, and are they finding it? And I want to say we're hearing your new baby on your lap as we talk.
Yes. They are finding it. I mean, they're able to kind of network all over Houston. They're looking for somebody just to come once a week and make sure that they're, you know, doing this work from school correctly. So I think there's a lot of different things they're looking for, and there's been tons of connections being made. So they're definitely finding the help they need.
Yeah, tons of connections being made. Are parents talking at all about the cost? And of those who are they finding ways to help with the cost?
Yes. So we've had, sadly, a few heated debates about cost, and it's hard. I totally understand. I mean, nobody anticipated this, and it's definitely expensive to hire a private tutor. We've had a couple of parents come in and, you know, worried about children whose parents can't afford this. And so they've gone to their churches and seen if they can open up, you know, a room at the church and just get a volunteer to come and help the kids online. I've heard of some local YMCAs opening up. There's a couple just nonprofits that are, you know, finding space in community centers and stuff. So I think that so far, I mean, people are getting inventive and kind of figuring out how to solve the problem if they can't afford it.
I'm also thinking about a potential social cost to this experiment in education? I mean, are you seeing parents literally staying in their own bubble when forming these pods, maybe by race or belief or socioeconomic status? Or are there parents in Houston who are seeking out that diversity? Some people are now calling those equity pods.
I would say in Houston, yes. I feel like Houston's really a melting pot. Our neighborhoods are very diverse. So I haven't really seen, you know, anybody excluding anyone or anything like that. I would think if there's any sort of exclusion and it's not on purpose, it would end up being a socioeconomic situation, mm-hmm. just because I don't know how many low-income families necessarily have access to a group, sure. or computers or anything like that. So that's it's a definite group of people that we need to get in touch with.
Yeah, yeah. We're really seeing a melding and a changing of the way we're teaching our children in this moment. Do you think, though, this pandemic will reshape education as we know it moving forward? So much has happened just in the last few months.
I think it already has. I really hope that, you know, it's a big awakening for all of us, that we remember that childhood is the greatest gift. You know, we spend our entire adult lives wishing we were still children, and how did it go by so fast? And so my hope is that all of us, you know, parents and teachers alike, remember that these are their most formative years, and it is precious, and we need to make sure that we make it amazing for them.
Stephanie Briles is the founder of Quarantine Houston, a Facebook group for parents seeking to form pandemic pods. Thank you for talking with us, Stephanie.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, as you heard Stephanie say, not everyone can afford private tutors. So in some parts of the country, community groups are filling the need for extra support for families. And let's bring in Lakeisha Young. She's executive director of Oakland Reach in California. And Lakeisha, you organized a summer program called The Hub to provide stipends and laptops and virtual learning tools for about 200 students. Tell us more about it.
So the way that The Hub looked this summer is it was broken into three centers powered through Google Classroom and Zoom, and they had live teachers. We hired 15 teachers to teach them. Our kindergarten through second grade students participate in something called the Literacy Liberation Center, which was focused all on literacy. And they were in school from 10 to 1, 5 days a week. And then our third through eighth graders participated in something called the National Summer School Initiative. And they were in school 5 days a week from 9 to 12:35. For about 3 days a week, the kids also had the opportunity to participate in afternoon enrichments. So they did martial arts, urban farming, which is this combination of cooking, and they had science projects. And then they also had an option with creative writing. So we created a full learning day and experience for the kids. But in addition to that, which I think is really unique to what we built to serve our communities, is two things. One is every family had a family liaison. That's like that person who is supporting you from everything to setting up an email to, you know, talking you off the ledge if it's just becoming too much. It's almost like an educational social worker. So that was uniquely how we set up The Hub, keeping in mind that the health concerns of our families are first and forefront, right? In their minds, we have people, multi-generations living in the same household. So again, potting up with someone else, even in a low cost scenario or no cost scenario, it's just really not an option for many of our families.
Yeah. So you've been able to produce this proof of concept as we go into the fall. School has already started in Oakland yesterday. School is virtual now. What does the hub look like as we move through the school year? And I'm guessing you'd love to be able to see this replicated in other parts of the country where the need is also great.
Yes. I mean, you just said it perfectly, Tanya. But as the school year kicks off, we're kind of looking at it this way. We see our families probably falling into two categories this fall. So we have parents who are happy with how their schools have responded in COVID in terms of distance learning. And as we speak, their kids got their Chromebooks, they've got what they needed, and they're ready to, and they're online learning, and they feel good about it. But they love The Hub. And they love The Hub because as a parent, you are being provided the supports needed to really, like, raise your game to support your child in this new normal that will be lasting for quite a long time. And we are at the table with our district partners and our sort of charter management organization, CMO partners, but we are designing this really based on the needs and desires of our families, because in Oakland, just like in other cities, low-income families, just like families with, you know, more privilege, both have the same desires for their kids to go to college. They also are pretty discontent about the instruction and the educational plans that they were receiving. And so the hub, you know, is about how do we design what works for our communities? Pods work mm-hmm. for a certain community, but the hub needs to exist for a lot of other kind of families, but it does require fundraising to make this happen.
Lakeisha Young is executive director of Oakland Reach, which is developing a system for online education support for the school year, and it is already underway. Lakeisha, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
As the country reckons with racial injustice, many people are turning to books that deal with race or anti-racism. And Ralph Ellison's terrific Invisible Man is on many of the recommended reading lists circulating online. It's a book that President Obama has cited as a major influence on his own development. Vermont Public Radio's Anna Van Dyne explains how the novel began in a barn in the Green Mountain State.
Let's go back 75 years to summer 1945. World War II was coming to an end, and a young man serving in the Merchant Marine had fallen ill. His name was Ralph Waldo Ellison. On his medical leave, he decided to visit Vermont.
He was obviously excited to be in that particular state, especially in the summertime, thrilled to have free time, but also laboring all the while to try to find his voice as a novelist.
That's Arnold Rampersad, who wrote a biography of Ellison. He says Ellison was planning to use the time to start a book.
He was not sure that he was a novelist, but he was determined to become a novelist.
Eventually, he did. In 1952, Ralph Ellison published Invisible Man, a book narrated by an unnamed young black man, invisible due to others' refusal to see him for who he is because of the color of his skin. It became the first book by an African-American writer to win the National Book Award. And Ellison started it that summer of 1945. He was staying with friends from Harlem, John and Emily Bates, in their summer house in Fayston, Vermont. There were three little girls in the house, too, Joan, Diana, and Grace.
I'm Grace Ann Bates, and I am the daughter, one of the daughters of John and Emily Bates.
Back then, Grace Bates was just 5 years old. She remembers there was no running water, and just about the only car that drove by belonged to the mailman.
As a child, it was just heaven. It was just nothing but playing in the mud, playing in the brook, picking berries.
While Grace and her sisters played, Ellison sat in the barn, trying to write his novel. And then something happened. Here he is in a 1966 TV interview.
Certain things that I'd been doing, reading, thinking about, came into focus. It's sort of unconscious focus, as often happens when you're writing something.
Ellison says he'd been thinking about mythological heroes and historical figures and what it meant to be an African-American leader at the time. This was before the civil rights movement of the 60s. And one morning, sitting in that barn,
I wrote the first sentence of what later became Invisible Man. I'm an invisible man. And I played with that, started to reject it, but it intrigued me, and I began to put other things with it. And pretty soon, I had a novel going.
Ellison later explained that the book's opening line was delivered to him by, quote, a taunting, disembodied voice. He tried to ignore it, but he couldn't. Something that had happened in Vermont was on his mind, too. He'd seen a poster in a nearby town for a blackface minstrel show. He was surprised. He wrote that he'd, quote, thought such entertainment a thing of the past, but there in a quiet northern village, it was alive and kicking.
It absolutely speaks to the ways in which these minstrel shows and other aspects of racism were popular throughout the entire country, and that the North also had major issues around segregation and racism, and was not at all, you know, sort of immune somehow as a liberal space.
Jennifer DeVere Brody directs the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity at Stanford University.
I think that what was surprising for him was to see the ways in which race continues as a trope and slavery as a kind of formative understanding of American race relations.
Ellison's novel takes place in the South and in New York and contains no mention of Vermont. But biographer Arnold Rampersad says it's not surprising Ellison's moment of inspiration happened where it did.
Ellison saw all around him examples of people who did not know history, did not know their own history, did not know their own sacrifice, you know, but were good people, but having lost connection to an earlier time when they were, in some respects, the center of the American moral world, certainly the liberal world. And that was what he was trying to investigate in modern terms in Invisible Man.
Ellison left Vermont with the beginnings of his book, which he published 7 years later. He never returned to that farm in Fayston before his death in 1994. Yawoo Miller, the son of Grace Bates, whose parents hosted Ellison, grew up visiting Vermont in the summers.
And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I understood the connection between Invisible Man and this place.
And when he did,
it just made the world feel a little bit smaller, you know?
Miller says there are other connections, too.
I drove by a Black Lives Matter protest down there in Waitsfield. It was probably about seven people. But, I mean, I know that there have been protests all over Vermont. It's just kind of cool to see people recognizing the little bits of history that have happened here and also connecting to a broader movement that's happening across the country.
As for the barn, it fell into a state of disrepair and was torn down years ago. All that remains is a pile of stones, barely visible in a tangle of undergrowth, and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man that began there 75 years ago. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Van Dyne.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.